This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm Will Arimus.
And I'm April Glazer.
Hey everyone, welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America.
We are recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, November 28th. On today's show, we'll revisit the pending death of net neutrality and how people who are concerned about that can stop it. We'll also discuss YouTube's ongoing problems airing disturbing videos involving children, and then a conversation with Lena Khan, the legal policy director of the Open Markets Institute, to talk about AT&T's now troubled attempt to merge with Time Warner and the DOJ's rare challenge of that, as well as how this impacts tech companies. And lastly, don't close my tabs, our picks for the best on the web this week.
All right, April, how are you doing in this post-Thanksgiving week?
I'm good. I am happy to be back at work, actually. How are you doing, Will?
Weirdly, I feel the same. I'm ready for more news. Bring it on.
Okay, you're going to wish you hadn't have said that. Well, what's been kind of catching your eye this week? I know a lot has happened on the YouTube front.
Yeah, so there are some new developments in a story we talked about on one of our first episodes. If you'll recall, YouTube got in trouble when the New York Times found some seriously disturbing children's videos on its site for kids called YouTube Kids. Everything there was supposed to be kid safe. There was really gross and creepy stuff on there. Now YouTube is in trouble again for a different but related problem, which is that videos on their main site, so this is just YouTube.com, the one everybody goes to, that exploit kids in various ways. You have these videos, a lot of them originating from Eastern Europe, showing young children in vulnerable scenarios. They have kids tied up in a doctor's chair, like having violent procedures done on them. There was one where a man in a clown suit kidnaps a kid and stuffs him into a washing machine. I mean, this is really awful stuff. But the thing about it is that it's like so weird that it manages to avoid the algorithmic moderation that YouTube uses. So they use this software that's designed to catch, for example, child pornography or physical violence or that kind of thing. But it doesn't catch stuff that's just plain like weird and disturbing. And so BuzzFeed found a lot of these types of videos, brought them to YouTube's attention, and YouTube took them down. But BuzzFeed actually discovered that they'd been brought to YouTube's attention before, and YouTube did not take them down until it was splashed all over the web and all over Twitter. It looks like the company once again has been slow to respond. Now advertisers who are seeing their ads run against this kind of awful content are pulling out. This is the second time this year, actually, that there's been several major companies pulling out of advertising on YouTube. But I think what bothers me about it is not that they can't get a handle on this stuff, but that they always assure us that they do. It's like, oh, we've got this under control. There was a problem with the algorithm, but we've fixed that. There was another story that might sound totally unrelated, but it's the same kind of theme, where last week ProPublica, the investigative reporting nonprofit, found that Facebook had was still allowing people to post racially discriminatory housing ads. This was something that ProPublica first brought our attention to a year ago. Facebook said, oh, we're so sorry about that. We'll fix it. The government said, oh, good, Facebook's going to fix it. So the government closed its investigation. And then ProPublica comes back a year later. And it turns out Facebook didn't fix it. You can still place ads, housing ads on Facebook that exclude, for instance, black people or people who have an interest in Islam. This should be illegal. And nobody, the government does not seem to be up to the task of holding them accountable. It's just journalists who are doing it really right now.
The thing that bothers me the most is that nonprofits and advocacy groups have called, and individuals who are concerned have raised these concerns multiple times, and nothing is done unless there's the like blaring light of the press on them. And so clearly there's a lack of respect for their users in this case. And they're just not going to do anything unless they're pressed to.
No, it's going to be really hard. I liked your point about the fact that you know, they don't seem to have the will to take care of this. It's an interesting analogy is the issue of copyrighted material on these types of platforms. You know, we saw originally on YouTube, a big issue was that they were, you know, there were pirated shows, but the recording industries and the studios had the legal power mm-hmm. to force them to develop algorithms that really work for digital rights management. But there's nobody out there who's representing the interests of kids in Eastern Europe in the same way and putting, you know, money into forcing these companies to take that kind of responsibility. It'll be really interesting to see whether just being publicly shamed is enough to do the trick. But April, tell me about the big story on your beat this week. I have a feeling it's going to have a familiar ring.
Yeah, and that's a really good point about them being excellent when it comes to copyright violations, but not when it comes to child exploitation. So I've been focusing on network neutrality. It's something that we talked about last week because Chairman Pai, who was appointed by Trump, although he was at the FCC prior to his appointment of being the chairman of the commission under Trump, dropped his proposal that would officially rescind the network neutrality rules that were passed in 2015 under President Obama. And it was a real Thanksgiving news dump, right? And we're now analyzing that, thinking about what that means, and just looking at this, you know, really menacing timeline for when net neutrality will no longer be a set of rules that internet providers like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T have to follow.
So I understand there have been some problems with the comment process.
Yeah, you know, the FCC, when they're proposing new rules, they ask the public to comment on what they think of those rules before finalizing them. And in this case, when the FCC opened up a window for the public to weigh in about their thoughts on the proposal to repeal net neutrality, there were a lot of irregularities that popped up. For one, it was discovered by researchers that a lot of bots or automated accounts had been posting comments. There were 22 million comments posted, by the way. It was the largest proceeding in terms of public participation in the FCC's history. And when I say bots, I don't just mean like forms that you fill out from an advocacy website that helps you comment to the FCC. I mean like there's not actually a person there behind the comment posting it. It's just being done in an automated way. There were also comments from dead people in the docket, right? And those comments from bots and dead people were actually a minority of the comments and were also representing views that were against net neutrality, so that were in favor of Pai's proposal. The overwhelming majority of the millions of comments that were submitted were organic. They were from people that were actually supporting the idea of keeping the net neutrality rules and not going along with Pai's idea. So with all of those irregularities, Jessica Rosenworcel, who is a FCC commissioner, has been calling for public hearings to occur to kind of give the public a fair shot at weighing in. There was also a cyber attack on the comment system during this time, right? So there was just so many things that happened. You know, some people are saying that it's time to slow down and give the public a fair shot to say their piece about, you know, why net neutrality matters to them or why it doesn't.
All right. But I mean, how realistic is that at this point? Because it seems pretty clear that even though the comment process was clearly flawed, and that seems like a big problem that has to be addressed for the future, if nothing else, it was pretty clear that people were against this. I mean, the FCC knew that most people do not want this. They're, you know, Chairman Ajit Pai wanted to push it through anyway. What realistic hope, if any, is there for the folks who still hope to stop it somehow?
Right. And so, you know, the fact that Pai dropped the news on Thanksgiving and the fact that this is being pushed through, regardless of the fact that there were all these irregularities, shows that there's an agenda here. And the agenda is to repeal net neutrality. And that could happen, you know, as early as by the end of January, the rules could be off the books, right? The FCC is slated to vote mid-December. And that means the majority of the commission is Republican. They will probably vote along with Pai. That means that, you know, about a month and a half after that, after, you know, they're published in the Federal Register and everything is processed, by the end of January, internet providers will be allowed to offer websites, you know, fast access to users for a fee and create kind of this tiered internet. Now, there are some things that people can do. You know, for one, people can call Congress, call their representatives, and tell their representatives, particularly if they're Republicans, to pressure the FCC through back channels. You know, it doesn't have to be this public proclamation, but pressure the FCC to pull the brakes and reconsider. And the way to do that would be to make a convincing argument, perhaps, that, you know, having a tiered internet would be harmful to your business, or that ISP discrimination would be bad for your nonprofit, or, you know, you're afraid as a local internet user. But really make the case to representatives that your vote is on the line about this, and that they need to step in and urge the FCC to stop this. And the truth is that PI does have the kind of political cover to shrink back and to say, you know, actually, we're going to stop for a second. And that's because there are a number of cases right now, particularly one in the Supreme Court that AT&T has brought about, you know, the FCC's authority to even be regulating here.
I admire that you still have hope on this front. I think this may be one case where I am more skeptical or more pessimistic than you are. I mean, Ajit Pai was brought in to do exactly this. I don't see the hope here, but I admire those who are still fighting the good fight.
Yeah, you know, I think that this is not going to be over. I mean, we do expect, you know, there to be court challenges to this once the rules are passed. But just because there's a court challenge doesn't mean that an injunction is going to be granted. And that doesn't mean that necessarily the ISPs will be stopped from discriminating. I want to make sure that people understand that just because, you know, these are definitely going to be challenged in court, that doesn't mean that things won't continue down the path that PI would like them to continue in the interim. And really, you know, this is a time for people to make a big fuss about this. So and to target that to probably Republican representatives. We did see that work, you know, for instance, in Obamacare, there were a few people that split with their party, you know, because they did feel such pressure from their constituents. So we might see something similar here.
All right, April, I think we can leave it there for now. This is definitely an issue that is not going away, and we're not going to stop talking about it. Apologies to listeners who aren't interested, but it's a big deal. Now it's time for a short break. When we come back, we'll have our interview with Lina Khan.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So a quick note to our listeners before our interview. Lina Khan, who will be joining us, is with the Open Markets Institute, which used to be part of New America, a partner of If Then, the podcast that you're listening to. Open Markets and New America parted ways over a controversy regarding Google, a longtime funder of New America. Open Markets has long been critical of Google's market power and the way they exercise that. And there was a very public dispute about the way that funding is leveraged and how it affected Open Markets. That said, we are jazzed to have Lina join us. She is a total expert in her field. Our guest today is Lina Khan. She's the legal policy director of the Open Markets Institute and a visiting fellow at Yale Law School. She writes about antitrust law and competition policy. Thanks so much for joining us, Lina.
Good to be here.
So we're going to mostly focus this conversation on the proposed merger between AT&T, a massive telecom, and Time Warner, which is a huge content distributor. They own things like HBO and CNN, and that's an $85 billion deal that's on the table. But before that merger can glide through and actually happen, it needs to be approved by the U.S. government. And Trump's Department of Justice has challenged that merger. As of last week, they said that as of right now, the way the merger is structured, it does not allow for enough competition in the market, and that some structural changes need to occur in order for the merger to pass the muster of the federal government. These types of things don't happen often in the antitrust world. Should we be concerned about the action that's being taken here?
So I think it's actually worth recalling that challenges to vertical mergers was actually a mainstay of antitrust through the 60s and 70s, and actually even as recently as the late 1990s. So, late 90s, Time Warner was merging with Turner, which was the merger of these two programming operators. And at that time, the Federal Trade Commission noted that Time Warner had an affiliation with TCI, which was a cable operator, and observed that there was a potential conflict of interest that would emerge. And so the FTC permitted that merger to go through, but required a divestiture to separate the cable operator from the programmer to make sure that there was no conflict of interest in this way. So that dynamic is exactly what's at play with this deal, where you have a vertical merger again on the table between a programming operator and a distributor. And so I think, the issues that we're seeing are actually issues that we've seen before and that the government has challenged before, too.
And so just to clarify, when you say a vertical merger, you're talking about a merger between two companies that are really sort of in different businesses, whereas a horizontal merger is one like when AT&T tried to merge with T-Mobile. Those are both wireless companies, and that, in fact, was blocked on antitrust grounds, right?
Exactly. So a horizontal merger is when you have two companies that compete in exactly the same sector and exactly the same line of business that are trying to merge. So, when you see all the rental cars mergers between Dollar Thrifty and Hertz and Avis and Budget, those are all, horizontal mergers, whereas vertical mergers is when you have two companies that are oftentimes in the same industry but are operating at different points in the supply chain. So, if you had a bakery merge with a flour mill, for example, it would be an instance where kind of an input into the baker was kind of being acquired by the baker.
Why is it bad, though, if this merger did go through? Or why is that, why is the DOJ's challenge here? Why does it make sense?
So the worry is that AT&T DirecTV, which is a dominant distributor, will use its control over content, which it would have through acquiring Time Warner, to basically discriminate against or disfavor rivals so that they can no longer compete on a level playing field. So Time Warner has a lot of, must-have content, be it through HBO or be it through TNT, which carries a lot of sport networks. And basically what the merged entity will be able to do is go to other distributors and basically jack up the cost of carrying Time Warner content. And in the past, if Time Warner were to jack up the cost of its content, these other distributors would be able to, walk away, and that would hurt Time Warner in the form of lower revenues. But the worry is that once Time Warner is merged with AT&T DirecTV, even if other distributors walk away, what that will mean is that that other company will be less competitive because it will no longer be carrying this must-have content. And so that we can potentially then see subscribers defect from rival distributors back to AT&T DirecTV. And so what this merger would do is create a perverse incentive for AT&T DirecTV to jack up the price of content, and then it would benefit either way, either through its rivals having to pay it more, and so it would be able to extort all these other companies, or in the form of gaining more subscribers precisely because it's depriving competitors of that must-have content.
All right, so zooming out for a second, this is an interesting situation politically, because it's a time when a lot of people on the left are actually finding themselves in alignment with the Trump administration on something, right? Because people from the left have been calling for stricter scrutiny, stricter antitrust scrutiny of a lot of these kinds of mergers for a long time. Nobody's been listening to them. Now under Trump, we're doing it. But the concern, one of the concerns here is, is this really a shift in philosophy, as you say, or is it, a result of Trump's personal vendettas? Because, there's a lot of the talk about potential antitrust scrutiny of Amazon, which I think we'll get to in a minute. That has been fueled by Trump's personal enmity to the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, who also owns Amazon. I mean, we don't want a situation where the executive branch is using antitrust scrutiny as a lever to punish his political rivals, right?
Absolutely. A vengeance-based or vendetta-based antitrust approach would be deeply disturbing, deeply troubling. I think this puts us in a difficult position insofar it raises the question of, you know, what do you do when the Trump administration is doing the right thing potentially for the wrong reason? And so I think, you know, this is definitely a situation where we think Congress should hold oversight hearings and basically ensure that there was no improper political interference or meddling from the White House. And so I think, you know, that would be one potential check on this. I do think that this approach of requiring structural divestitures is actually consistent with conservative philosophy. And so, you know, Maykan Del Rahim, who's the new head of the antitrust division, gave a speech the other week where he basically laid out this case for structural relief, noting that, you know, antitrust is a law enforcement regime. And so you really want the government to basically be creating the incentive structures so that companies, you know, are acting in pro-competitive ways. What you don't want to put the government in the position of is policing business conduct in kind of a day-to-day way, which is what the kind of behavioral conditions the Obama administration relied on did. It kind of made it put Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission in more of a regulatory role. And so I think, you know, there are ways to square what's happening with a consistent conservative philosophy, even if that approach was not taken by, say, the Bush administration. But I would totally agree that we're in a very strange moment right now politically, where you are seeing the Trump administration do something that a lot of people who've been troubled by excessive concentration, excessive monopolization think should be done. But there are now all these additional questions about whether it is improper political motivations that is leading the Justice Department to do this. So no doubt this is a strange moment.
On one hand, we have, you know, Trump's FCC pursuing a deregulatory agenda that would grant companies like, you know, AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, even more power and the power to make even more money, at least when it comes to how they distribute broadband. And then, you know, over at the DOJ, when it comes to antitrust, we see the, you know, Trump's Department of Justice trying to limit the power of AT&T. So it does seem like there's kind of two things happening simultaneously that don't necessarily harmonize quite well.
I would totally agree. You know, there's total incoherence here, not just at the level of, you know, one approach is favoring AT&T and the other is disfavoring it, but even at the level of, you know, net neutrality is really about ensuring that dominant ISPs are not able to discriminate, right? It's kind of a regime of kind of equal access. And what you see in the AT&T situation is basically the government saying you cannot discriminate. You know, we're not going to allow a market structure to emerge that will give this merged entity the power to discriminate against its rivals, against other content producers, against other programmers. And yet in the net neutrality space, what we're seeing the government say is actually these rules that were prohibiting discrimination, we're just going to do away with them. So it's definitely an inconsistent and incoherent approach that we're seeing.
All right. So because we're a tech show, we're interested in the implications here for Silicon Valley. I mean, this is another elephant in the room, I think, when you see this kind of antitrust action in the Time Warner AT&T deal, is what might be coming next for companies like Amazon, which Donald Trump has already talked about applying scrutiny to, but also some of the big platforms like Google and Facebook. I mean, I know there is a large contingent of people, including some of your team, who thinks that they should be broken up in various ways. You know, does this signal that might be coming, and what can those companies take away from what's going on right now?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, we don't yet know what the enforcement priorities of the Trump antitrust agencies will be. I think at the level of, you know, what are the theories of harm that are being identified here, it's basically the government saying certain forms of vertical integration create conflicts of interest that we think are impermissible and we think are anti-competitive, right? So basically, when you have a distributor and a content provider merge, that creates conflicts of interest. I think that as a theory, as a philosophy, is something that should worry the big tech platforms, because they also are massively vertically integrated in all sorts of ways that you could say are analogous to the kind of AT&T, DirecTV, Time Warner situation that would be created. So I definitely think that government taking a stricter approach to vertical deals and the conflicts of interest that they create should be worrying to the big tech platforms.
So we probably won't see Google buying Netflix anytime soon.
You know, they might, but I think it would be an interesting question to see whether the agencies would go ahead and challenge that.
All right. I have one last question for you. You wrote an article in the Yale Law Journal earlier this year, I think an op-ed in the New York Times, making the case that Amazon may be getting too big and may, you know, may need to be somehow broken up or reined in. Can you briefly make that case? Because, you know, when I write about Amazon and antitrust, you know, I always hear from Amazon later and they point out things. Well, like, look, in the retail sector, you know, we're very small. Walmart's way bigger than us. And if you want to make, you know, e-commerce a sector, they argue that that's not really a sector. They're saying basically there's no industry we play in where we are the huge giant. And so this whole idea that we're too big is misguided. How do you respond to that?
Sure. So the best way to get out of an antitrust case is just to redefine the market, right? So, you know, most antitrust cases begin by asking, you know, what is the market definition? And so that's kind of a key place in which if you just rejigger how you define the market, you can just say, hey, look, this is actually a very competitive market, nothing to see here. I think the issue with Amazon is that it very much benefits from that kind of siloed sector by sector approach. The real issue here is how integrated Amazon is across all these different sectors and how in many ways it's become a form of infrastructure for all of these other companies that now depend on it. I think you see it as a form of virtual infrastructure where its platform is so dominant. So, you know, something like 50% of all online shopping searches now begin on Amazon's platform. That share is only growing. So, you know, if you're an independent seller or producer and you want to get to market, you basically have to ride Amazon's rails so that you're visible to the public. It's increasingly also true in the sense of physical infrastructure. So Amazon has invested extensively in building out its physical network and delivery and logistics capabilities so that a host of other producers and retailers are now also dependent on its physical logistics and infrastructure. And it's also true in the cloud where, you know, Amazon Web Services is by far the largest player and is growing there too. And so I think if you start viewing Amazon as a form of infrastructure and then realize that it is competing with the very businesses that are dependent on its infrastructure, and that creates a core conflict of interest that we have in the past recognized as anti-competitive, I think that's where you start seeing these broader antitrust principles come into play. I should also say that in certain sectors, mm-hmm. Amazon is actually pretty dominant. So if you take the ebook market, which you are able to, you know, define as a standalone market, Amazon, I believe, has over 60% of that sector. And so I think, you know, both on a sector by sector basis, in some instances, and as an integrated entity, Amazon's power should be considered anti-competitive.
Right. Even its own brand, Amazon Basics, is kind of the top brand in some small categories, I understand it. I am curious, what can people do who are concerned about, you know, Facebook or Google or Amazon's dominance, but are so locked into these platforms, you know, yet feel that they have gotten too big, but really can't help but use them?
I think when it comes to political actions, it's really about continuing to pressure lawmakers and members of Congress. I think, you know, we've seen a dramatic shift in the last couple of years when it comes to members of Congress and how they're viewing the platforms. Uh-huh. 2-3 years ago, you know, we would meet with staffers and they would just say, you know, these companies are untouchable. Consumers love them. There's no way that you're going to start an anti-monopoly movement by talking about their power. And yet, if you look at the last 6 months, I think that conversation has changed in many key ways, in part because you've had, you know, situations like the Russia Facebook incident. Mm-hmm. And kind of, I think what we're seeing is that there's this growing political awareness, and then you can have about the excessive power that these tech platforms are wielding, and then you have these incidents that end up acting as catalyzing moments where suddenly there's an opening for change and an opening for thinking about new legislative actions or new rules and regulations that could address their power. So I think continue to you know, express to lawmakers that this is something that people are concerned about is definitely something that people can do.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, Lena. This has been a great conversation. Learned a ton.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break, and then we'll have Don't Close My Tabs, some of our favorite things we've seen online this week.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right, it's time again for Don't Close My Tabs. April, what tab could you not close this week?
So this is not like a particular story that was that incredible, but it was the subject of it and what it means that really struck me. And that was a story in Select All, the New York Mag's kind of tech vertical, on how the Tumblr founder, David Karp, is stepping down. I'm just thinking a lot about that because that could mean that Tumblr might not be around for that long. Will, you probably remember when Tumblr was acquired by Yahoo, right? That was a few years ago now?
Yeah, I was at the press conference in New York where Marissa Mayer very excitedly announced the acquisition, and everybody in the crowd was like, oh no, that's going to be the end of Tumblr.
Right. And I'm just thinking with this that with the loss of Tumblr, if we do lose Tumblr, we might not, of course, it might be revived, but, you know, losing the CEO, we're not really sure what the future of it is. But if it does go away, that means that, you know, along with Vine not being around, we're going to have one less place on the internet that's a popular place where people can kind of be weird together and start communities. I really enjoyed making kind of weird, kind of artsy, random tumblers of photos that I thought were kind of a funny collection to put together. It also means kind of one less web page, social media icon on the bottom of every, you know, article that you see or place that you visit, right? So now we're just going to see kind of the Twitter bird, a big F, and then a little camera that's owned by that big F, Facebook. We're not going to see that lowercase T Tumblr anymore. It was a corner of the internet that I actually really enjoyed. But my potentially preemptive Tumblr nostalgia aside, it could be saved. Will, what was your tab this week? What could you not close?
All right. I couldn't close this tab that was from a website I'd never heard of before called Stanford Politics, which describes itself as an award-winning nonpartisan student news magazine. I went to Stanford about a decade ago. This magazine did not exist, but now everybody was reading it because it had this fascinating cover story. The headline was How Peter Thiel and the Stanford Review Built a Silicon Valley Empire. Peter Thiel, of course, the famous Silicon Valley funder, part of the so-called PayPal mafia, an early investor in Facebook. He still sits on Facebook's board and an extremely controversial figure in the tech world for his outspoken libertarian views, his views that giving women the franchise has been bad for democracy. He is he's sui generis. He's a friend of Trump and an ally of Trump, one of the few in Silicon Valley. This is sort of Thiel's origin story. It's a story of where his weird brand of conservatism came from and this kind of conservative subculture at Stanford, which is a very, very liberal campus overall. There's a publication there called the Stanford Review that is this contrarian conservative publication. I remember it from my days when I was editing the Stanford Daily, which was the main student newspaper. They actually plagiarized one of our stories. Anyway, the Stanford Review has just somehow cultivated these really sort of virulent strains of libertarian conservatism that have veered away from the political mainstream in the United States. And so this story is about that sort of weird conservative subculture on a liberal campus. Apparently, Thiel, actually, before he bankrolled the lawsuits that drove Gawker out of business, he told a group of students at the Stanford Review, a group of undergrads at the time, he was excited and apparently couldn't contain his mirth, according to this report. He said that he was about to have a huge takedown. He was going to destroy what he called a universally reviled organization. So I was just really engrossed by the idea that this otherwise liberal atmosphere can foster an extra virulent strain of conservatism. It reminded me of a profile a few months back that San Francisco Magazine did of the Breitbart editor, Marlowe, who was a UC Berkeley student and probably faced a similar situation there politically.
Yeah, what was interesting to me about the Stanford Review case is that this isn't just conservatism, like in like a socially conservative sense. This is more kind of libertarianism. And particularly, it seems kind of connected to this kind of tech libertarianism or this kind of idea of being anti-government or anti, you know, big government and regulation in particular. So we're not just talking about kind of right-wing values, we're talking about kind of a market philosophy here, right?
There is this linkage with Silicon Valley values where, you know, most of Silicon Valley leans left, but there is this strain of thinking where you can kind of, you know, where society should really be this meritocracy, and that we can engineer society in ways that are more efficient. And even though Thiel's views are in the minority in Silicon Valley, his thinking does represent something that is part of the overall Silicon Valley ethos that they're now imposing on the country and the world in various ways.
Right. It's better to use software than laws, perhaps, to regulate things, is the Silicon Valley ethos. And we might find strains of that in the Stanford Review, which Thiel seems to have a particular fondness for.
Yeah, he founded it, actually. I should have mentioned that.
Right, right. Well, that's a great tab. Mine is just more kind of sad. Yours is super interesting.
Oh, mine's definitely sad enough, too. It's all sad this week. Maybe we'll come back with a happy one next week. All right, that's our show. You can get updates about what's coming up next by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod. You can also email us at ifthen@slate.com.
You can follow me and Will on Twitter as well. I'm at April Laser, and Will is at Will Oremus.
Thanks again to our guest, Lena Khan, for joining us. You can find her on Twitter at Lena M. Khan.
We also have a favor to ask of our listeners. If you like this show, please go to iTunes and Stitcher or wherever you listen and leave us a review. This does a lot for helping us get the word out about the show, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, it really does help. I was so excited to see our show near the top of the rankings on iTunes this week for technology podcasts. Thank you so much to our listeners. We're really flattered that you're spending your time with us. If Then is a product of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is the wonderful Max Jacobs.
Thanks to Jesse Nichols at Fantasy Studios in Berkeley, and thanks for the additional help at Slate in D.C. from Afim Shapiro.
Thanks to Don Aulis and A Room with a VU Studio in Santa Barbara. Our awesome theme music is provided by Doug Chase. We will see you next Wednesday.
Bye.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.